This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll is all my brain and body need. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Very good indeed.
All right. Best thing about high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age. Classic McConaughey.
Oh, mate, I love him. He gets
sick. He's brilliant. Well, there was a period where all he'd do was like shitty romantic comedies.
Yeah.
And then he just proved that he's actually an incredible actor.
Mate, what did
Dallas Buyers Club?
Oh, what a film!
Killer Joe,
yeah,
phenomenal.
Yeah. Oh, dude, even in Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, well, he's very self-aware, isn't he? When he's in fucking Wolf of Wall Street, and he's doing.
Oh,
that.
Yeah.
Like he's aware of the Matthew McConaughey persona, and he can up to it.
Yeah, man.
There was There was a band he was doing some shows with, and he's just shirtless playing bongos with them. I can't remember who it was. It was like the Dave Matthews Band or something like that.
Right.
But he's just on stage with them. There's photos, and he's just like lost in the groove. You can tell he's someone who smokes a bit of weed.
Of course he does.
Has a good time,
yeah.
And ain't afraid to send himself up, which is what I love. Because actors are rare breeds, aren't they? And some of them can be a little bit precious.
Yeah, take it too seriously.
Yeah.
Where he's talented enough to be able to. It's like when you see Marx Brothers playing the piano, but playing it badly, like Les Dawson. You've got to be able to play it well in order to play it badly. And that's the same as Matthew McConaughey. He's a fucking great actor. So he's able to fuck about with it.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah, there's that notion as well that you have to know the rules to know how to break them as well. So when people like dissect art and you might think, oh, that's just scrappy and shit. It's like, no, they know that the formulaic approach is there and it can work, but it's more fun sometimes to play with that formula.
Of course it is, man. It's nothing better than breaking the rules, man.
They're there to be broken, right?
I struggle with that. I get worried because I get caught out. Like when I was a kid, you know, doing something silly, you know, it goes again, I'm a nice guy and blah, blah, blah. And then I do something daft and then get caught. So now I'm like, oh God, and so I've been a rule breaker. So,
you have to deal with the consequences of your actions. Don't
of course you?
You
do.
And if you're someone who's a good person, then you don't want to be perceived as a bad person.
Exactly, so man.
You can't be writing checks that your ass can't cash. So where did you grow up, brother? Where was home for you as a wee lad?
I was born in Bromley Hospital in Kent, which is like Kent, South East London border.
Ashford was where I was born.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I thought you were, because I was going to say, because you said you're from Birmingham, but you haven't got the accent.
Thank God.
Sorry to any Brummies listening.
I can say I'm from here. It is, I think, the most unattractive accent on females and just one of the thickest accents on blokes.
Wow.
And no disrespect, huge. I'm from Birmingham, I can say it, and I haven't actively avoided the accent. It's not like I've gone to elocution lessons.
No.
I think it's just, I moved to Solihull, which is an area of Birmingham, when I was 2 or 3.
Yeah.
So I was born in Ashford, but then my parents moved from south up to the Midlands because my dad's job. And so I've been in Birmingham for most of my life. I lived in Exeter for 4 years when I was a student down there, and London for a few years and moving back there. But it's just an accent that I've never really had. And maybe it's because I've been broadcasting for the last 10 years. Because actually, there's a lot of footage of me from when I was about 17, 18, 19,
yeah,
where me and my mates would film us getting up to all kinds of pranks and things. And I look back at that footage now, and I sound very Brummy then.
Okay.
But I think maybe after going on the radio, and you're aware that your voice has to be decipherable to as broad an audience as possible.
Yes.
So maybe there has been a slight subconscious, subtle element of, yeah, honing it down so I can be understood,
yeah,
by as many people as possible. Occasionally it comes out with certain words, but I think unless you're Ozzy Osbourne, yeah, you can't pull it off. Ozzy sounds great. Yeah, yeah. Hello, Matt! He's brilliant. But anyone else? But yeah, so sorry.
No, Kent. No, you're right. But you're, yeah, so if you say like words like bath instead of bath.
I say bath.
Yeah.
Yeah, I say, where's the, and I actually say bathroom. Someone last night at the Glee Club was saying it's funny because I'm
Aldabel.
I'm American, so I call the toilet the bathroom, and someone asked me, where's the toilet? I go, it's probably in the bathroom. Have you looked there? Brilliant. But I actually do say, if I'm in a pub, I do say, where's the bathroom, please?
Yeah.
I guess I'm a little bit posh. I wish I was.
Well, my brilliant ex-wife, India.
She's... Do you have a healthy relationship, do you?
Yeah. Oh, it's all good. Yeah, she's a classy lady, and she's gone off, she's met someone great, and she's married and happy, and it's all beautiful, man. And she's from Dadlington, which is just outside of Leicester.
Right.
So she's got, and she went to good schools and did well, and you know, so she's got, she didn't really have that accent either, but every now and again she'd say grass and bath.
Yeah.
That was the only telltale sign.
After you've had a few drinks, maybe, you're with some hometown friends, then it definitely rises.
Or she'd
to the surface,
say bab.
Yeah.
She says it because everyone bab.
You're right, bab. You're right, bab. Yeah, I'm all right. Oh. Noddy Holder, he's actually another great Midlands hero.
He is, and he went with Christmas about Noddy Holder.
You're right. Do you know that they probably make, still to this day, I think about £1 million a year off that
Jesus.
Song. At least.
They must like do.
They just live off the royalties of that one song alone.
Amazing.
And they were the highest selling band for singles in the 70s in the UK.
Really?
In fact, not a lot of people know. They were as big as the Beatles, because what they had was every football fan would be singing Slade down in the terraces.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just tapped into that. They were basically the Oasis of their day.
Yeah.
And Oasis wear, I think, that influence very proudly on their sleeve.
Of course,
they covered Come On Feel the Noise as well.
But that's how I first heard that song.
Every 70s bloke...
Yeah,
they had as a fan, because they were a lads band, like a 70s lads band, and they were huge.
Mate, Slade, when I was a kid, I hated Slade, I wasn't bothered. It wasn't until later on, and I heard the cover by Oasis, and that's what made me go
and
back
at the
and
end,
have a look.
They're going, Yamo, come on, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Yam, yam, that's what it's from, and that's what made me go back and then discover Slade in Flame and
they're a hard rock and roll band,
fucking
man.
Their early stuff is banging, man.
And Sweet, we were saying earlier.
Sweet as
Sweet,
well.
Slade, Mud, all that 70s glam
cause
stuff.
Because you only know the singles.
Yeah.
When you go back into it and check
the deep
the album,
cuts.
Fuck, man.
And that
brilliant
Slade album cover where they're like that and they've got it written on their fingers. Because they write out all the song titles as they pronounce them phonetically, don't they?
That's it, yeah.
So it's like, come on, feel the noise, spelled C-U-M. Like,
yeah, well, that was when Vic and Bob did them.
Yeah.
Like, get down and get with it. And so that's the thing. Growing up, I grew up in Alpington in Kent, so not far from Bromley, which, you know, you had the Bromley contingent, you had Susie Sue, and you had Billy Idol, and all the, like, the punk, that, you know, the Bromley contingent being the punk mob. David Bowie, he's from there, and so it was, you know, I grew up in a very, now I realise it's very interesting, but when I was growing up, it was just boring. It was just this
small town.
Small satellite town outside London, not much going on, no scenes. It's one of those towns where you just, London was everything.
Yes,
You were like, I cannot wait until
Paul
I'm
Weller
in
says
London.
That a lot, doesn't he?
Yeah,
he came
exactly,
from a similar
kind of woken, And it's that your entire life is just focused on getting into London, doing London. And so when Manchester came along, that was like, we used to fantasize. I'd sit around and fantasize about, oh, yeah, we'll get enough money to go to the Hacienda, you know, and shit like that when I was a kid. I'm glad we didn't when I hear what went on.
Well, my dad's from Manchester. He was never into that scene. But my cousin Lewis is probably about your age, late 40s. And he used to go there all the time, and he's got all the stories.
Yeah.
You know, you can only imagine, well, it's still in effect now, the positive rippling effects that whole movement had on Manchester as a city, culturally.
Yeah,
it just completely rejuvenated the whole place. And it was, for a while, the centre of the UK music scene, wasn't it?
Everything. And so you had the main bands, the Mondays and the Roses, and then off that, you had all the connected, like you had Northside, and you had all these other bands, like the Charlatans and things like that. And And it just became this magical, because you've never been, I'd never really travelled. I didn't go on a plane until 1998. You know, I'd never been anywhere. So this magical place of Manchester, with all these exotic bands coming around, was just, I bought all the vinyl. I was just obsessed. And we used to walk around in pink kickers and we had the curtains and the...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was just, oh, it was an incredible time. That late 80s, early 90s was a magical period. And then, you know, we discovered, we were doing acid. We weren't doing E then, we were doing acid. And acid was...
Well, it was the second summer of love, wasn't it?
Oh, man, it was amazing. It was fucking amazing. Everyone was on a beautiful vibe. And when I think back to it now, I'm like, it just feels like the sun was always shining.
Yeah.
And it was a great time. Music,
a nice rose-tinted
yeah,
world.
Yeah, exactly, man. And the music was banging. You know, and, you know, you were just... And then, and from that, you learned about older bands because, like...
People well, Donovan like, and people like that.
Donovan and Hot Chocolate, because there was a story that went round about Sean Ryder locked in his studio playing You Sexy Thing on a loop. And you go, well, and you're like, well, Sean Ryder likes it. I fucking like it.
Yeah.
And then listen to that, then I like Carl Denver and all these things. And you're that it just opened up this whole thing. And then you had like Primal Scream really smashed it into and brought two sides together, like how, you know, dance music and rock music. And so there's this big swirling mass of things and all the lines just got washed away. It was like, because when I was growing up, my dad had all the Rolling Stones and Dylan and all these really cool music, but it wasn't cool to listen to. So I'd have cassettes of it that I'd put together and then like, hide them from my mates. And so they'd come around and so they'd see all my Beastie Boys and all that stuff that, you know, was great. But, you know, I was embarrassed to say that I was listening to the Stones. And so when the Mondays blew up and... All of a sudden,
I mean, particularly Primal Scream, yeah, who were so influenced
by the Stones. Exactly. When that came out, when Screamadelica blew up, and it was just, and I remember people coming around my house, and I'm like, oh, I could put some music on, and they go through my dad's book, going, oh my God, you've got this, you've got that, you've got the White Album by the Beatles. The Beatles were not cool in my house; they weren't cool till I discovered them in '94.
Yeah, and then you had Oasis making them
exactly.
cool.
Exactly. That was why. Because in my house, my dad was always like, no, the Beatles are a girls' band. We don't have the Beatles in this.
So he was a Stones head, was he?
Stones, the blues, real, yeah. And so I remember it clearly. I remember it clearly. I remember Liam and Noel banging on about Eye of the Walrus. And I'm like, I've got to check this song out, man. I was living with this guy, Stuart, and he had the red and the blue best ofs.
Yep.
And I'm like, right. So I remember sitting there and I put on I Am the Walrus for the first time on headphones.
Cuckoo, ka-ching.
Oh, my God.
Sean Ryder, lyrically, mate, was clearly inspired by that nonsensical approach as well.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't he?
I mean, he's a poet.
Yeah.
Sean Ryder is a fucking poet. And there's some people that would just go, oh, no, he can't sing. No, he can't sing, but he's brilliant.
But neither can Dylan or Neil
Young,
really.
No, exactly, man. Of course not. And that the best singers can't sing.
Yeah.
I don't want to listen to Craig David. I don't care if you're note perfect. It's boring.
Yeah.
I want to listen to this dude. I want to listen to Marquis Smith. I want to listen to these people that are more interesting rather than you know.
Yeah, they're idiosyncratic.
Yeah, you go, what? And straight away you go, that's Marquis Smith.
Yeah.
That's who that is. You fucking know, you know, and I love that.
Hit the north.
Ah, dude. Fucking touch sensitive when that comes on. Oh, my God. I've been very lucky to have been able to have DJed once or twice. And I have total respect for people like yourself that can do it because it isn't just playing other people's music.
Yeah, you've
it's
got to take people on a journey, haven't you?
Chemistry. There's a way, because I remember doing it and I remember putting Touch Sensitive on and the place went fucking boom. And I was a god. Like, yeah, I fucking got this. Like riding this
but
wave.
But then once you've got him, you've got to keep him.
Exactly. And then you drop something else and then people just go, fuck that.
Yeah.
And you're, oh my God, I've lost
the floor.
Because people
on a dance floor are so fickle and the sooner you learn the lesson that it's not about being cool or elitist, it's about
exactly.
just... The trick is getting the girls on the dance floor and then the guys follow. And so
many
songs.
Well, I've been at parties and I know people that they're putting on music that they want to listen to.
Yeah.
No. You've got to find a happy balance between what you want to hear and what they want to hear. There's no point you just putting on fucking rare Kinks B-sides because they might not want to dig that.
Yep.
They want something. They want to listen to Groovers in the Heart by D-Light.
Oh, dude. What an album that is.
Banger. Yeah, it's a great album,
great
man.
Album.
Yeah. And so that taught me. We used to, where it started, I used to work for these brilliant lads selling t-shirts at Glastonbury and all these other festivals, And so we'd have this really...
Was it legal, or were you one of the guys outside?
No, it's proper. It was proper. All, it was inside. it was like a festival shirt.
Long sleeve of five, a £10 Euros.
Oh, no, this was... These were T-shirts with, like, cops take drugs written on them.
Right, cool.
So it was like festival T-shirts.
Well, that was the other thing with that movement, wasn't there, was a brand awareness. People were into slogans and certain brands.
Yeah, which again...
Like fashion had a whole revival, didn't
it? Yeah. Well, that was it. And it, I mean, that, if you look back, you know, I'm not into football, but I see I love the fact that football and music and fashion, there's a Venn diagram of these things.
Yeah.
And you see, I remember there was a great film, Away Days, which I I'm not into football, but that is one of my favourite films, because it's not just about the football, it's about the culture around it, and the relationship between the two lads that are in it. Like they say, it was quite homoerotic. There was this main dude in this football gang that this young lad wanted to be in. He's like, you know, and we've all been there. Like, oh, I want to be with the cool kids.
Someone you idolise and look up to.
And then it turns out that this main dude, when he goes around to his house and he goes, well, I'm into that, but it's not for you, man. It's fucking shit. We should get to Berlin and we should listen to this. And he's playing him.
Low by David Bowie.
Yeah, and Joy Division and all that. And it's like alternative to the football stuff. And, you know, it's such a fucking good film. And then you've got the other side of it. There's a bit where they all walk around the corner in slow motion. I think it's in Birmingham. There's all the Brummy lads dressed like Slade.
Yeah.
And they walk around, all these fucking casuals, and they walk around. There's this bit, and one of them just puts his arms in the air like that as they're walking up. And it's fucking brilliant. And the hairs on my neck going up now, just talking about it.
I've never seen it, man.
Oh,
I have to check it out.
Got to see it. Stephen Graham, brilliant.
Oh, he's in it, isn't he?
Brilliant in it, yeah. The two lads that are in it are absolutely first class.
Amazing.
And it talks about football and fashion and music and... It's a fucking great film. It really sums up that period, late 70s, early 80s era. And I love that. So I don't know where I've gone on this tangent, but...
I guess you were at the right age, at the right time, for a really great period in music.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just missed out on a lot of that. I remember Oasis were my introduction to probably contemporary guitar music. I was about 6 or 7 or something, maybe
right.
8 or 9.
All right, mate,
I'm 33, so I'm
what?
About...
Oh, God.
14 years younger than you.
14 years older than you. Mind you, the same age.
Well, you blew my mind last night when you said that you've got a 27-year-old
dad? 27, yeah.
We'll get to that in a bit. But yeah, I think that period in time, as you say, that late 80s, early 90s, indie just explosion off the back of the Hacienda movement, really.
Yeah, dude, it was incredible.
And it shifted it away from London. And obviously, you know, you were in the South as a kid growing up there. London was never really on my radar growing up in Birmingham because we always had a healthy music scene here then, and gigs were always happening. All the major tours would all come to Birmingham.
Yeah.
And so the concept of like London as this beacon of art and culture was never really on my radar.
I suppose it's the city that's nearest you.
Yeah.
So, and because back then there was still that north-south divide.
Oh, there still is now. Massive.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
There really
really?
Is.
Think it's, cause
do,
I would,
do you
cause,
not?
Well, I travel
I think
around
people who live in London are just... They're not even aware of a world outside.
Now, yes,
of it.
That's very true, and that's
and they never leave London, and they're not even like fucking. They don't care
because the only people that can afford to live in London are fucking wankers.
Yeah,
and I back that up 100%. They are a bag of.
I'm moving
cunts.
Back there in 2 weeks.
Yeah,
I can't afford to though. That's the key difference.
You fucking wanker. I'm moving out. It's. I think. Yeah, there wasn't. I travel around a lot, and I'm very lucky to do what I do. I go all to different cities. I love Sheffield. I love Leeds.
Dude, I'm getting tour envy being in your hotel room now because this just reminds me of being on the road.
Oh, mate.
And I love it for that reason. Leeds, Sheffield, Manchester, Bristol, Newcastle, Glasgow.
Yeah.
Going to these cities that all have their unique individual strengths and character.
That's it.
And I do find, I'm sure you'll agree that the further north you get, the friendlier people get.
Yeah,
as
man.
Well.
Yeah, because it's
you
cold.
You can make friends with strangers.
It's
super
cold.
Quick.
You don't want to stay warm. This is why the accent changes as you go up. I remember this conversation with Rob that I used to do the T-shirt store with. I remember him saying to me because he was from Doncaster.
Donny.
From fucking Donny.
Donny.
And he said, I remember him saying, he goes to me, yeah, well, you know, the further north you get, it gets colder. So that's why the accent changes, because it's clipped vowels. We want to get what we need to say out quickly, because we're going to freeze to death.
Yeah.
And that's why everyone's more friendly, because like, yeah, come in, have a cup of tea, because we can't stand out here. We're going to die. You know?
Yeah.
It's amazing. There is that friendliness. And London
it's
does
a cold
exist.
Place.
Oh,
cold,
dude.
Like,
and it,
emotionally.
Yeah,
London
it's
is.
Unsympathetic. It doesn't care about you. You go there, and you have to keep up. it doesn't look, it won't look back to see where you are.
No.
And if you can't keep up, tough shit, get out.
Yeah, yeah. Because
there's plenty of other people that will come and do it. It's a fucking odd place, London, and it's had so much. At the moment, it's a building site. The whole place is
everything
just,
is just under development.
Just
all the
developing
time,
the whole
it?
Thing, and you're like, fuck, you have smashed the soul out of this once great city.
Places like Denmark Street in Soho.
Oh mate, it's tragic.
It used to be venue, guitar shop.
And you had,
now it's just fucking Pret-a-Manger's and flats. Yeah. And you have your London Astoria venue.
Oh, the Astoria was amazing. It was a fucking great venue. I remember seeing loads of bands there. I saw Mel C there, actually.
There you go.
She was cracking.
Alan McGee was going to manage her briefly.
Really?
But then, yeah, it didn't work
she
out.
She was
yeah.
brilliant,
she's
mate.
Cool. She's cool. Yeah. She seems cool.
It's a good gig, that. Really good gig. Yeah, they knocked down that, and they just flattened the whole thing. It's just becoming a fucking rich person's playground. And there's nothing there because rich people have no taste.
And they don't want to protect the history of... Here's an interesting thing, actually, with Paris and Notre Dame. Have you seen that some business guy was like, here's 300 million to rebuild
it? Yeah.
And a lot of people are like, well, historical buildings are obviously important, but can we not give that 300 million to fucking...
I was the same. I was one of those people.
Third world countries
that
need our help.
I was like, well, again, like...
It's right.
Yeah. It's like, what? Hold on, we can find nearly €1 billion in an afternoon. But we can't... What? We can't find €1 billion
to... solve world hunger with that.
€1 billion. Can you imagine how much shit that would clear up? Yet we don't. You know, these billionaires aren't interested, you know. And then you get called out because I made a comment online and then someone was like, well, why are you doing it online? What's the point in that? I'm like, I have to say it somewhere. I can't walk out into the street and say it.
Just shout it.
I just need to say it because this is fucking bananas that we're not helping people. Like you and I walking around last night. There's a homeless person every 2 feet. And
Birmingham
like,
has
fuck,
changed
man.
So much for the worse in the last five to 6 years. I left in 2014 after Kerrang and went to London for a couple of years. And when I came back 2 years ago in 2017, the number of homeless people seemed to have tripled.
Yeah.
And it is. It's literally around every single
it's
corner.
It's terrifying, mate. It's terrifying. And they
and
all
London
get...
is fucking obviously the worst because it's the biggest. And again, going back to that idea of just businesses and corporations just... ripping the heart out of London.
Yeah.
And if you can't, as you say, you can't keep up, tough shit.
Tough shit. And all the people they're pushing all the people out that were born there, and they're all getting pushed out to like Canterbury and, you know, these shitty towns like Grimsby and things like that. And, you know, the business people run this world and they don't give a fuck. They don't give a fuck. They're buying up properties in these big cities. Not even living in them. Just,
I know, yeah, that's the other thing, yeah. Like, some Russian fucking billionaire just got us one week a year holiday.
It's just
home.
This one big game of Monopoly to them while some poor fucker hasn't got a roof over his head, you know. And luckily, we're getting into the summer now, so it's...
London, in the summer is a good place to be.
Beautiful place.
Do you still have love for the South? Are you still very much a Southerner? Do you identify as a Southerner, or you're not geographically tied down in that way?
I sound like a Southerner.
Obviously, you say,
I mean, I don't.
White sand,
Which is it's amazing because I'm not actually like that, but I've got this wonderful accent that, yeah. But I think because of what I do, I don't feel. I feel more. It sounds really wanky, but I feel more a part of.
The whole world.
I've realised now, being lucky enough to travel a lot. That...
Do you gig outside of the UK a lot?
Yeah. We were just out in, we just did some gigs in Holland.
Wow.
Yeah, and I've been to the States. I've been to the Middle East.
The Middle East?
Yeah, we did some gigs for the troops and stuff like that. And that was cool. Went to Kabul and all that shit. And
I bet they're the most generous audience, right? Because they just want to fucking be entertained.
They're just happy to see you.
Yeah.
And part of that as well, you go, I'm making money from war, a war that shouldn't be happening. And you're like, oh God, but yeah, I've got bills to pay. And, you know,
but it's the same as like a caterer going out there. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, same.
They still deserve entertainment and need food.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't feel guilty that you're not capitalizing on it. Do you know what I mean? You're giving them as much as you're getting financially. You're giving them something that's going to get them through the fucking next few days.
And when you talk to the men and women that are out there, and you have a conversation with them, and they're the same. They're like, yeah, we get it, but this is what we signed up for. You know, we didn't really have. It's not really what I wanted to do, but there wasn't a lot of options, and this is a good career, and blah blah blah. And so you get them on a human level, and you realise, oh yeah, we're all hustling. We're all we're trying to do is survive, and it's
poor people fighting rich people's wars as well.
Of course,
it is.
The generals on the hill. The generals
they're
on the hill
in the
sending
fucking
us
hut with a cigar.
Exactly, mate.
Having the fine
wine.
Yeah,
and it's fucking heartbreaking. I've done gigs for the people when they've come back from war. I remember the first time I did it, I walked out into the main bit where we were doing the gig, and there was a young girl on crutches, and she was pulling herself along on the crutches, and her legs were like dragging behind her. And I freaked out. So I've worked with old people and people with disabilities before. I've never seen someone that I'm like, a human being did that to you. You got blown up. And I went back in the office when Angie, the woman who runs the CSC, was in there. She goes, you're all right. I went, yeah, I just need a minute because I've not seen this before and it's too much. She was like, yeah, you'll be all right. They're just people. They've just had a bad thing happen to them. I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right. And went out there and then it was fine. But, you know, fuck.
That As you say, though, it's something that's been inflicted by another human rather than just you're born with a disability.
Exactly. And which I know is weird, but is... Yeah, it puts a different spin on it.
Of course, because you see the absolute fucking brutality that the human race is capable of.
Oh, mate, human beings, man. I know we love and hate in equal measure, and you know, and we're just animals, really. We've got a consciousness, so we know we're aware of ourselves, which other animals aren't so much, I suppose. But we're still fucking animals. Half of us want to kill the other.
Well,
half,
we're arguably the worst animal in the whole kingdom, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, I mean, we are just a scourge on the earth. We are just raging through it. We are wiping out, you know.
Like, do other animals kill and rape?
Ducks.
Do they?
I think ducks rape.
Do they? And dolphins.
Dolphins rape. Dolphins. Do they?
Sadistic fuckers.
I thought dolphins
but
were cool.
That's because they're, I think, almost as highly evolved as, well, not almost, but they're more highly evolved than most other animals. They're as close to us in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, I heard that.
So that's why they've got that rapiness in them. Because it is mad, isn't it? You can't imagine like a tiger going to kill a bison or whatever they're hunting in the fucking Serengeti, wherever they are, and then just leaving the body. I mean, they're not killing for pleasure or sport.
No.
They're killing because they want to eat and survive.
That's right. Yeah.
We're the only fuckers that do that, aren't we?
Oh, man, we are fucked.
So how did you get into comedy? What was the inspiration?
I'd always loved...
Did you grow up inspired by certain comedians, or did you just have a funny side to you from a young age that you wanted to explore more?
I never in a million years thought that I'd be a comic. That was something that other people did. It's like being in a band. That never occurred to me.
You can make a living from
it. Yeah, I loved music. I wanted to be a drummer. My dad said it. My drumming sounds like someone pushing a shed down the stairs. But it never occurred to me. That was other people did that, and it was only till
was it as easy to get into when you started as it? I've had is a, now, or is it harder now?
It's harder now.
It's harder now because there's
so many people wanting to do it. There's a lot of the big major clubs that you could have got into that would have helped you along the way have all closed down.
So it's the same with a lot of the live comedy venues as well as the music ones.
Oh, exactly the same. Yeah,
dropping off left, right, and
centre. Yeah, yeah. It's hard. I wouldn't want to be starting now.
No,
and it's getting harder for brand new comics, and a lot of young people coming through. They don't seem to want to do the circuit. They're like, I want to get on telly.
Yeah, well, it's like that fast track way to get on panel shows, isn't it? Yeah, and that seems to be the end game now.
Yeah, some people they don't want to be comedians. They want to just be, they want to be on the television.
Personalities, celebrities, almost.
Yeah. Whereas I never in a million years thought I'd be a comic. I just happened to be. I'd always loved comedy. I've got a mate of mine, Tom, that I've known since we were 3 years old. And he was almost like an older brother to me. He was almost like introducing me to Bill Hicks.
Right on.
Cypress Hill. You know, all these things. He was like, I've heard this. Have you seen this? He was always had this stuff. And so that's how I got into liking comedy. And then we'd hang out. And I didn't realise, because he's really funny.
Your mate.
Yeah, Tom. And I was always trying to make Tom laugh. And if I got Tom to laugh, it was a real buzz. And then I realised I was making a few people laugh. I was like, I quite like that. And that was it. That was it. Didn't go any further. And then I'd had this major breakup later on. It was this girl. I loved her deeply. And it all went to shit because we were taking drugs and being fucking assholes. Ended up, I was working at a funeral director's. So it was a very dark time. It was winter. I'm back at my mum's. I was just about to turn 30. And I'm like, this is fucking shit.
And I was That's all the elements right there, isn't it? Funeral home, back at your mum's, single.
It was so bad.
And then you've got kids at this point as
well. Yeah, I've got kids, and so I'm dealing with the mum and the guilt of not being with them and all that shit, and it's all going on. And I remember being in the canteen of the funeral directors, and I turned the page over in this newspaper, and there was this advert for Up the Creek. Bar people needed. And I'm like, well, I've worked in a pub before. I can do that. I worked at the Lazy Toad in Beckenham.
What a great name for a pub.
Great. The Lazy it's not there Toad. Anymore, unfortunately. I was 18. It's called the Lazy Toad.
I'm going to nick that.
Yeah,
I'm
do
gonna,
it.
I'm going to call my basement in my new flat that. I'm going to get a little basement bar, the Lazy Toad.
Do it, the Lazy
it
Toad.
Come
do
out
it.
For a drink.
Fuck yeah. We get T-shirts. Fucking right. Fist bump, man. So I went, oh, I can do that. So I remember ringing him up and I spoke to what I now know to be Drew, one of the owners. And he goes, all right. He goes, well, come and see me tomorrow. This was on the Friday.
So is it a comedy club?
Yeah, it's in Greenwich. Yeah. And it's one of the, it's been going for years. It's
still there?
Yeah, still there. It was called the Tunnel Club originally. All the greats used to go there, Vic and Bob and everybody, and Jules Holland, they used to hang around down there. It was a real hub. So I get there, and Drew meets me, and he's like, he goes, okay, yeah, come through. So he goes, right, this is where we do the comedy. I'm like, oh, brilliant. Yeah, people are coming in, it's Friday night, it's getting ready for club night. Takes through to the bar, he goes, right, that's the bar. He goes, you can pull a pint? I mean, yeah. He goes, all right, start tomorrow. Like, really? You went, yeah, that's it. That's
all you can pull a pint? Yeah, you're in.
You're in. Brilliant. I was like, oh, right, okay. You went, yeah, you're welcome to watch the comedy. I'm like, oh, okay, thanks very much. So he goes off and I'm stood there.
It's got to be the best bar job working
at a comedy
store.
It was fucking amazing. I got to see.
Because you're just entertained every night, aren't you?
Mate, I used to see, this was in 2001, January 2001. So people like Jimmy Carr, they weren't famous yet. They'd come down and doing their stuff, and Michael McIntyre was on in the middle, and you know, and people were just, you know, it was fucking great. It was amazing. I was like, I love this. This is incredible. And then getting friendly with a few comics, and then Rob Rouse, another comic, he's in Upstart Crow at the minute, and he was going, I think you'd be good at comedy, Rich. I'm like, I don't know, man. He goes, yeah, because you've got that glint in your eye. He goes, I think you should give it a bash. Then I became friends with another guy called Silky, and Silky had his own clubs. Silky and I, one day I was running up the creek. By now I'd moved to Maidstone. There's another one in Maidstone. I was the manager of that. Having a drink afterwards in this crappy club, and he just went. He goes, I think you should do it. I'm like, oh yeah, I don't know. He goes, right, your first gig is on this date. It's in 2 months' time. You can't back out. You got to do it. It's in Bam. It was in where was it? It was in Oxford. It's on Cowley Road, the Bullingdon, which is a great music venue. And he goes, right, and you've got to do it. You can't back out. And for 2 months,
that's the push you need, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and I shit
backing
my pants.
Out.
Yeah, did the gig, did 2.5 minutes of the 5 I was supposed
two
to do.
Two and a half.
Yeah, I was supposed to do 5. Bottled it.
Really?
I did. Yeah, I did. What I got one joke out
because you felt like you were bombing. So you
No. I got a good laugh, but I couldn't remember what else I was going to say.
Right.
I just went, ah, fuck. And there's a rule. I can't remember. It's somebody's law. And like, if it's going badly, get off. If it's going well, get off. And it's called something law. And as I'm on, Silky's voice came over the house speakers, and he just went, blah, blah, law. I went, oh, yeah, bye. And I got off, and he went, yeah. He goes, good. You're going to be the resident open spot. Every month, you're going to be in this gig. Like, fuck.
Off the back of one show,
off
just
that.
Like that?
Yeah, because we were mates. He went, yeah. He goes, I reckon you can do this. You've got to come back. And he had me doing that, and then he put me on in his clubs in Banbury. Put me on all of his clubs in Wales.
Is that where you're going tomorrow on the way back?
Yeah, no, it is next door to where it used to be.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that was how it started. I was mates with Silky. He gave me all my first gigs. My ex-girlfriend, Marilyn, was running up the creek that they had in Croydon, and they were going to close it on a Friday. And Marilyn said, look, don't close it. Why don't we do this? Why don't we get Rich to MC every Friday for cheap? That gives him stage time. And we get established acts either end, new in the middle. That keeps your costs down. That keeps it open. Everyone's happy. And so I did that. And so she got me doing that every Friday. I'd go down and MC that. And then because I was MCing up the creek and they didn't know the arrangement we had outside of the club, they didn't know I was doing it for cheap and I hadn't been going very long. They'd be like, oh, you do up the creek? Oh, well, come and do this. So then I got in with the backyard. I got in with the comedy calf. I got in with jonglers. I got in with all these. And before I knew it, like 3 years in, I'm getting paid work. All of a sudden, I've gone from
just like that.
100 quid a week. It took me 3 years to get from 100 quid a week to like 600-800 quid a week. And it was massive. And it just snowballed from there. And all of a sudden, I'm 14 years in and I've never looked back. It's amazing. And I never even knew I was going to be a comic. That's the main thing. I didn't know.
You never sat down one day and went, I'm going to go for this. It just was an organic evolution.
Yeah. And because I've got kids, it was like, I have to make this work.
Yeah. I remember you telling me last night. Yeah. Because it's that financial drive, that hunger.
Yeah. This has to work. I'm now 47. I don't have another choice. This has to
work.
Yeah,
I'm fucking unemployable at this stage.
Yeah.
What
of course,
else
man.
Do?
I ain't going. Yeah. My desk could be upside down by lunchtime. I cannot go back to a normal job. So I'm fucked. This has to work. And so people say, what's your drive? Survival is all it is. You know, like I can't afford to sit back and be complacent. I have to make this work. And that's what pushes me on. And that's why we talked about last night, some of the bigger acts, when they get to that point where they're millionaires and
they don't have that hunger anymore.
Yeah. And it's a shame. I mean, I'd love to get to a point where I'm that comfortable, but I don't want to lose that.
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't want to lose that. I'd hate to lose that drive.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I think when you go to a certain length of time with the hunger still there, it never goes. Because a lot of people become successful quite quickly.
Yeah.
Oh, this is easy. And you sort of, you know, you throw in the towel a little bit to some extent. And it happens with bands a lot. You know, bands that get massive on that first album.
It doesn't really
happen anymore. But, you know, they get super famous super quick. And then you just see the quality dip. Like Guns N' Roses, bands like that, you know, they came out the gate so strong.
Yeah.
And then, I guess, drugs and fucking all egos and all of that.
Of course,
rips
yeah.
it all apart. It's obviously a very solitary existence. And I know, because I do a lot of DJing, and it's the same thing. I'm on tour, and it's just me in hotel rooms, on trains. You know, you get a lot of downtime, a lot of time to think. Obviously, as a comic, that's good, because you have a lot of time to write.
Yeah.
Do you get lonely?
Yes.
Yeah?
Very much so. And it's that's why, when I get to a hotel room, I put all my stuff out nice.
I've seen he's got all his gear, like, hung up, like he's at home. Yeah.
I unpack my bag, and so I'm all comfy. And then I keep myself busy. Like, I'll read, or I'll write stuff, try not to be on my phone too much, because there's that, you know, you get caught in this loop of masturbation and fucking social media, and you're like, oh God. And then you start getting depressed because you've spunked all the zinc out your body. You know? So it's important. I try and, you know, I haven't today, but I know tomorrow I'm going to have a day where I'm out of the hotel, and then I'm going to be hanging around waiting for my other gig. So there'll be a whole day of out.
Well, there's also a lot of waiting.
Oh,
and,
God,
you know,
yeah.
Because you know you have a show to do. Your mind's on it all day.
Yeah.
And it's, for me, in terms of nerves, the build-up and the wait is the worst part. Mm. Once you're on stage, it's all gone, isn't it?
Yeah. It's gone from...
Do you still get the nerves?
It's not so much nerves. I've realised now, I used to think it was nerves, but it's not. I'm anxious to get on.
Because
I love doing it. Yeah. It's excitement. I love it. And I'm really... My missus said this... If I haven't got a gig, I'm shocking. My ex-wife used to say that all the time. She's like, if you haven't got a gig, you're unbearable.
Really? What, you're just
I
down?
Because I live for that. Yeah, because I love doing it. I love making people laugh. It's such a fucking buzz.
It's the greatest gift that the world has, I think.
Being able to make people,
you can, and it had been a while. I got to watch you last night for the first time and loved it. And it had been a while since I'd been to a comedy club as like a guest.
Mm.
I've done a couple in the last year myself, performances.
Oh, yeah. And how did that feel? How did you...
For me, the first one was the best. The first one was great. I did it in LA.
Nice.
And what I found was my sense of humour and my material, if you will, was probably better suited to an American audience, because it's a bit more alternative, a bit more rock and roll.
Yeah.
And I noticed this last night as well, and maybe you could comment further on it, but it seems to me that a lot of UK... comedy nights and comedy clubs aren't so much people who are actually interested in comedy. It's just like a night out for a gang, a birthday party, an event. And then it really is like the most democratic form of entertainment, because it's like back to that Shakespearean age where you're really, it's without being like using a negative word, the peasants. Do you know what I mean?
Trolls, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's your basic blank blanket of just people, the public, the general public,
yes.
As opposed to Man of War are playing around the corner tonight. Everybody in that room is going to probably have a Man of War t-shirt on.
Yeah, a lot of that
and
today.
They're fully invested in it. Whereas with comedy shows, it's just like, oh, you know, I just thought I'd come along because everyone else is doing it. And so you don't, they're not on side from the start.
Yeah.
So you've got to fight and you've got to win them.
Yeah.
And with LA, I just got them straight away and it went great. And then I did three more shows, all in Birmingham, all at the Actress and Bishop. I guess amateur nights that me and two friends put on.
Yeah.
My friend was like, we should just start doing a comedy night at my pub. You can host and then we'll just get a bunch of acts from the area. So there wasn't really any names.
No.
So a lot of the time it was one comic brings two mates. So you get a lot of that as well. So you get like really heavy laughs from one person from like one area of the room and then they give you nothing for the rest of the night. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's tough. And I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy the Birmingham shows because I didn't enjoy the people that I was performing in front of.
I'm
no good because I've only done a few shows, so obviously I have so much work to do. But I just was like, it felt like this is lost on you, this material.
Oh, mate.
And then I'm like, well, fuck you then. Do you know what I mean? And that must be a really hard thing to come to terms with as well, because you must every night have to really fight, really struggle. And if you don't get them, there's always that one guy, isn't there, who's like stone-faced. And that would affect me in a very profound way.
Yeah.
And that would never go away.
I think the more you do it, the more of those things you get your head around and you go, you start to understand. Because we always had that thing, like imposter syndrome, where you're like, oh, I don't deserve to be here. This is shit. I'm shit. Blah, blah, blah. You get to a point, you have that many good gigs, you start riding that wave, don't you?
Yeah,
suddenly you go, oh, no, actually, no, I'm actually good at this. I've earned my place. Where I'm at now, I've earned it. I should be in this green room because I've worked really hard to get there, and that changes. So that you get that, but those gigs with the three people sat there, they're what build. They, you know, you because you're trying to. You go, okay, that was shit. I need to work out how to survive in those rooms.
Yes, well, it's all about the process of improvement, isn't
exactly.
it? And
that's
it's an
all it
ongoing,
is. Yeah.
continuous
yeah,
thing.
Man.
And those shit gigs are what inform you and make you a better performer.
That's it, man. It's like
if you've got the minerals to carry on.
Exactly. And you know after your first gig whether you want to do it again.
Yeah.
I always say that to people. They say, you got any advice? I go, not really, but just go and do it. You have to go and do a gig. If anyone listens to this and you're like, oh, I want to get into comedy, no point sitting there going, oh, I really want to get into comedy. Go and do it.
Spending months writing and rewriting.
Yeah, yeah.
Go and do it.
Go to a gig. Go and do it. Go and find an open mic night somewhere. Get up on stage and do it. And then after that first gig, I guarantee you, you will know if you want to do it again or if you'll never want to set foot up there again. It was interesting because I said to you, how did it go, your first one?
Yeah.
Oh, it was brilliant. And you were really buzzing. And I was like, oh, yeah, brilliant.
Oh, no, so that one as well, the one that you messaged me on was a festival in Bath that my friend put on.
Okay.
It was just like a hippy-dippy music festival.
Right.
And that one actually went really great because there's like sort of a kind of Bristolian, let's have a bit of a dab of MDMA. Like, although it was a family event, they were a bit loose and alternative. So that one actually went really well as well. But it was the ones in the pub when it's, as I say, a bit more of that.
That's it.
Let's get our shirt. And it's the way people dress up for it as well. Do you know what I mean?
No.
It's like they're going out fucking clubbing. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah. But there is this. I mean, the Glees are really good clubs. Like, they bridge that gap between, big groups of people that are going out on the lash and they're going out for comedy first.
Yes.
As a preamble to the clubbing that they're going to do later on. But they've also attract proper comedy savvy, you know, fans of comedy. So they're really in that, they really bridge that gap between those two things. There used to be clubs like Jonglers that were really all about
the people on the lash.
That's all it was. It was all geared to stags, hens.
Yeah.
And I'm no disrespect to them, because without them, they helped me get to where I am now, and they paid my bills and shit like that.
To the clientele. Who are coming in without any respect for the art form.
Yeah, not giving a fuck. They're like, and then they're getting fucked off because of food shit or whatever.
Yeah.
And
they're talking throughout sets and shit like that. And that must be fucking distracting and annoying as hell.
Well, those
there was
clubs,
none of that last night.
No, but this is the thing. This is what I'm saying. Like the Glee and the Comedy Store, Comedia as well in Brighton and Bath. They're very well policed. They've got great security. And the MC will go on and go, right, no talking, no this, no that. You know, have fun, but don't be cunts.
Yeah.
And if they do become cunts, then the staff there, the door people will come in and they'll give you a couple of warnings and then they'll just chuck you out. And those are the best clubs when there's been somewhere, there's been no one there, and it's been fucking unruly. As a compere, you can't control it.
What are some of your
it.
Worst experiences of that?
Oh, mate, there was one, and this guy threatened to punch me in the head.
He didn't shout it out across
the room.
No,
he didn't even do that. There was a big table of guys, and he was sat with his back to me, and the rest of the table were looking. And I wasn't smashing it. I was doing all right, you know. I was on first, and I'd not been going. I've only been going a few years, so. And then I saw this guy, and I'm like, mate, you know, you're not going to turn around. And he just leaned over to his mate and said loud enough that I could hear. He's like, tell him to fuck off. I'm going to punch him in the fucking head. And I went, you're going to punch me in the head? And he just looked at me and went, yeah, I fucking am. And I was like, oh, God. And then I lost the room completely. And the door staff were outside. They were fucking talking. So I'm trapped, you know. I'm like, oh, go and get my head punched in. And I came off, and the guy that runs the place, he was like, oh, how was that? I went, guy just fucking threatened me. He went, oh, well, it happens. And then just fucked off. He's a cunt, actually. Yeah. His name's Dave True.
Hey, name and shame.
Yeah, fucking Dave True. Go fuck yourself, you cunt. So, yeah, I've been very lucky. I've not had any mad
experiences. Have you ever been assaulted?
No, I've been lucky.
Is that common or not?
I know it's not common, but I know people that have had glasses thrown at them. And, Jim Jeffries became a name.
I love him.
Off the back of that. You know, he got punched at Comedy Store in Manchester. And that kind of elevated his name.
Well, sometimes it can help you out, can't it? Like that brilliant Bill Burr bit we were talking about.
Oh, last night.
Where he goes on stage, he goes, fucking, I got 10 more minutes. And he just goes to town on the crowd. And about a third of the way through, you can feel the tide turn.
That's it.
And he starts to win him over.
And he wins him over. By the end, they're counting down with him.
There's certain people who can get away with that and do that. There's certain people who their whole shtick is that they just berate the audience. Like a Frankie Boyle type.
Yeah.
He's obviously changed his style a bit in recent years. But, you know, those people, there's almost like it's a badge of honour if you're taking the piss out of, isn't it? So people almost expect it. And if they get it, they're a bit like, I was roasted. Like,
that's it. Yeah, there's a fine line. You have to be careful. Like last night, for instance, there was that guy in the front row.
Well, you were chatting to him at the end, and he was like, fine. Your best
mate. Yeah, yeah, that's it. And he was fine. That one I was talking to. There was another one on the other side.
Stone-faced
the entire night.
All night.
Just didn't want to be there. And I knew that straight away when I was talking to him. I was like, I'm not going to keep going with this. He's uncomfortable. This is going to make everyone else uncomfortable. This is already a tricky room because they were fucking lifeless at the top.
They were.
Had to really work hard. But... yeah, you know, I've seen other acts where they'll just hammer that into the floor, and you're like, "Dude, leave him alone. That's not going to end well."
Reflecting badly on you.
And in the end, I've seen it. They stood up and go, "Right, I will fucking kill you, you cunt." You know, and there's the act like, "Oh, I was only joking. I was only joking." You're like, mate, you fucking asked for that because you didn't leave him alone.
Yeah,
leave him alone. It's all very well having a bit of a laugh with the audience and taking the piss a little bit, but you've got to do it in a way that
you don't want to be mean spirited.
No, exactly. They've paid money. Yeah, they've paid money. They're here for a show, not to have you fucking. Tell them their life shit.
Yeah.
You have a bit of charm and a bit of this, but I'm lucky. I get away with murder. So
the thing that drew me towards it, and when I move to London, I want to try and get back into it and try my hand out at doing a bit more, is we've touched on it a couple of times, but I'd like to go in specifically on that. The idea of creating a momentum and controlling it and owning it. Because as you say, like a band... they've got the amplification and the set list and all the points, and you have to be a pretty shit live band to not get the room on side.
Yeah.
You know, here's my set list. I'm just going to perform them as they are. You're going to sing along. It can be quite an easy thing sometimes if you've got an arsenal of hits to just get out there and fucking go through the numbers, right? Whereas with comedy, you have to take ownership of that room, and you've got to, as you say, read the vibe and direct it and shape it. And that for me is the greatest feeling doing it, and the hardest thing in the world. It's such a skill. It's such a like subtle, incredibly multifaceted, multi-layered thing to be able to. You're basically directing,
and you've got to be able to come up with material that is palatable to the entire room.
To the entire room, they've all got different political beliefs, different tastes, interests, personalities,
and you can't please everyone. There'll be people there that it's different when you're on a bill like you saw last night, where there's four different acts on.
Very different as well. Very different. Very different.
Exactly. So everyone's going to get something that they like. Yeah. You know. And so
is that the goal when people are putting together these bills? Try and make it as varied as possible.
Make it as diverse as possible, and make it interesting, because you know for years it was always you'd have like four bald blokes in suits talking about their divorce, and you're more than that. And that's what's happening now. There's a major change going on, which is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And again, that's another reason why you've got to keep fighting, and you've got to keep, because now, you know, I'm a straight white dude.
Yeah.
Like, it's not fucking easy for
it's
me.
It's not very fashionable.
And I'm not, yeah, and I'm not complaining. I'm not going, oh, poor me. Exactly. You're like, oh, shit, yeah, I need to up my game and keep in it because it's very easy. Now they go, yeah, we don't need you now, mate. We're going to do this now. And other people are getting chances. You go, yeah. So in order to stay in the game, you've got to keep going. You've got to work really hard.
Like, yeah, man. Because
and again, that's all I've got. So you've got to make your material palatable for the entire room. Just keep it funny. Make a point, but make it funny. There's a whole level of sub-level stuff going on. There's many layers, you know.
Is emceeing a very different experience to actually just doing a routine? Because I'm thinking back, and I emceed the two nights at the Atchison Bishop in Birmingham, and they were the ones that didn't go so well, that I didn't enjoy. The bits where I just got up and did my 5 to 10 minutes,
yeah.
Or in this other place at the festival, I did 20. I remember telling you.
Oh yeah.
You do 20 minutes and you've done one gig. Is that
like,
nutter?
And then when you came back to me, you go, "Oh, it's brilliant."
Yeah.
And I was like really pleased for you. And in my head, I was like, I'm not gonna ruin it. I'm not gonna say that's what it's like. I was just like, "Oh, well done, yeah, brilliant. Well, keep going, man, keep going."
Yeah.
But I didn't want to go, yeah, listen.
Yeah,
you had a good one there.
Yeah.
Next one might not. I don't want to be that guy.
Of course. Well, I've read this book called Zen and the Art of Comedy. And it's a really good book about giving you the tools to write and perform and try and just, I guess, like a beginner's guide to stand. And it says, you know, like the first gig might be the best thing ever, second, great, but then third, shit.
Yeah.
And then that's when people go, oh, I'm just going to give it up.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
It's like you're not really a full-on stand-up until you've done, I think, 1,000 shows or something.
Yeah,
is what it said.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was, unfortunately.
Do you gig every single night?
I gig.
That's the other thing as well. So a lot of people, you've got to be doing it every night, all the time.
I gig
two or three a night. If you can, mate,
I gig all the time. I would gig every night if it was up to me. I mean, yeah. From now,
how many on average do you do a year?
Oh God, no idea a year.
200.
I do sort of between 3 and 5 a week.
Every week.
Every week, yeah. Most of the times, yeah.
So you're looking at about 200 to 250 gigs a year.
Yeah. And I've been doing it 14 years, so you know, like this week now. I haven't got a night off now until middle of May.
Really?
Yeah, I've got gigs of it every night.
A straight up month.
Yeah, just doing it.
Wow.
And then, you know.
And obviously, like with everything in life, the more you do it, the better you get.
Of course. And you get to a point now where when I'm on stage and I'll say something that might not land or I might fuck it up, I'm so comfortable to go, oh, that didn't work. Oh, well. What I was trying to do was this, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's do this one. And I'm up there just having a conversation with like 300 people.
Well, I have been doing a lot of live Q&A events over the last year, and that was what pushed me into this world of wanting to try it out, is because I was hosting a lot of shows with the Sanchez boys last year.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
and they were basically comedy shows. You know, we're telling funny stories about funny shit that they've done. And I was like, I reckon I could have a go at this because I've got enough mad stories from my life and my career.
Yeah.
But then what I found is it has to be to a specific audience because my shit is very specific. And
right.
What I loved about watching you last night is you absolutely smashed it when you're talking about all those 70s references about summer holidays start, you're just off on your own, you got to fend for yourself, and about the Nancy weird teacher. And there's all these references that the whole room of a certain age, obviously not everybody got it, but then you could also do the younger references because of the kids' material
that's
that
right.
you've got.
Yeah.
And you were hitting both demographics, the older and the younger generations, with very, I mean broad in a good sense, like broad material that everybody could relate to and connect with. Whereas mine was a lot more, I guess, self-indulgent and like, this is just funny shit.
Well, you're going with your own references, aren't you? But that's the thing.
If you don't have those reference points yourself, you're like, well, I don't care about a funny thing you did with Ozzy Osbourne.
Well, that's it. Because if people aren't into Ozzy Osbourne, then they're not going to be on board with that material.
Yep.
Or if you go on and you're talking about Slayer B-sides and they're like, I don't even know the
A-sides. Well, I'm not Andrew O'Neill. I wouldn't go that deep.
He's a great comic,
by the way.
He is
a great comic, yeah.
So it's, yeah.
You have to make it accessible, don't you?
Yes.
And then there's that thing. It's like the DJ thing. It goes back to that, actually. Were we saying that in this podcast or yours?
I'm losing track now.
But it's the same sort of thing as you can't be playing those niche, deep cuts to please yourself. And I guess it's the same in comedy, isn't it? It's like you have to make your material accessible.
That's it. Yeah, absolutely.
And play to the crowd, not for yourself.
And
there's
so many,
then there are comics that do just play for themselves and kill.
But are very good at what they do, and it takes it's a rare skill to be able to do that. And I don't know if I possess it or I'm not brave enough to do that, or I don't know. But all I want to do is make people laugh, and I don't care how I do it.
You're a man of the people, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's what people... Yeah. Do you like emceeing more than just performing, or do you not have a preference?
I like both, actually. I like doing a set. You can just do it on and off. But I love emceeing because there's a responsibility to it for
there
the
is,
entire night. Yeah.
And that's what I do with the Q&As. It's the same gig, essentially. Yeah. It's also a little bit easier to be funny if you're not the main event.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's less pressure.
Yeah. And going on and going, wow, that was
you're
great.
You're always the ace in the hole.
Yeah, you're like,
well,
like,
I wasn't expecting the host to be this funny.
All the time, mate, I get that so often. And then they're like, oh, you know.
You were the best part about the night almost, because
it's
like a surprise.
Yeah, because you're like, and you're in it with them. You're like,
that's it, yeah. There's a movement, isn't there? If you're just a performer that's doing your bit, you're almost this alien that's landed on their island for a brief period.
Come and have a party.
Yeah.
Come and have a party. It's when you're emceeing, listen, come with me. Have a really good time. I've got some brilliant acts.
Yeah.
Come with me, have a really good time. At the end of it, they go, wow, I'm so glad I came with you. I go, no, it was great, wasn't it? Let's do it again another time.
Yeah.
And that's where I come from with emceeing. It's an event.
An inclusive experience as well. Yeah.
And so even though I'm talking to people and having a bit of a laugh about their jobs, and there was someone that was who was a rail engineer yesterday. I just said, we fucking hate you.
Yeah. And the whole room loved it. Because they're like, I do hate fucking bus replacements.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
Everybody
does.
Yeah. But I still managed to do it in a way that
cheeky
kept them on
with
side.
A smile. Yeah. Exactly, rather than just shouting in their face.
Yeah. Like, you fucking cunt. Hey. So you know, is that speaking of gigs? I'm gonna have to go.
Are we?
Yeah.
All right.
Over time.
I don't know what are we on. Let's have a look. Oh yeah, we're at an hour. Fucking hell. Seamless. Yeah. Very, very quick topic.
We've got time.
I want to hone in on.
Yeah, man.
Give me a peek behind the curtain into the green room world of comics, because it's an area that fascinates me. I've been to a lot of music events where I've been backstage.
Yes.
And I know that world inside and out.
Yeah.
But I'm very intrigued by the comedy green room and what comedians talk about back there, and the mood and the vibe and the antics.
Yeah, it's all very different. It's all very different. It's funny, actually. It's very telling. Yesterday,
all just left, didn't they? After their bits.
Everyone left
last night.
Yeah. Or what you and you were, because we were sitting there. I was like, I'll get us a beer, and you were like, oh, you got beers in the green room, like a band.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
it
used to be like that. It isn't like that now. Like they still clubs like the Gleam is like that. They'll sort you out. They'll look after you. They're really cool. There's a lot of places now. You know they don't do that anymore. But The green rooms are very different. It all depends who's in there, because you know you've got people that you get on with really well. You've got people that you don't really know that well because you don't see them very often. But you're still civil. There's very few people on the circuit that are cunts.
There's very few.
Everybody knows who they are.
So there's a fairly common camaraderie
amongst
comics.
Everyone's pretty cool.
You're all equals and you're on the same page.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's a mutual respect generally across the board.
Yeah. I mean, for example, there was a big comic, it wasn't famous, but he was a major influence on so many people on the circuit. Ian Cognito sadly passed away last week before on stage. He died on his gig. He was doing his gig, he was smashing it. And then he walked to the back and he sat down on a stool. He put his head back. He put his arms in the air, and then he died. And that was
and people thought it was part of the act.
Yeah, they all thought it was part of that, like Tommy Cooper all those years ago. And that the outpouring of sadness across the circuit online. Everyone was talking about Cogsy. Really, it was like, oh yeah, there is still a love there for each other, and we still give a fuck. There is that. There's a couple of cunts, but you tolerate them and it doesn't matter.
They're everywhere.
On the whole, everyone's pretty cool. And you go into green rooms and we might be talking about what's been going on lately, or we might be talking about whatever. You know, you're having a laugh backstage. Like last night, I was having a real laugh with Susie McCabe.
She's brilliant.
She's fucking great, man. We're having a right laugh, and you know, and Al
LaBelle. My partner got the dogs. I got the guy's diabetes.
So there's that, and it's lovely. And sometimes you have a drink afterwards if you're away from home, or you just go do your gig and then you leave. But
who are the party animals on the scene? Are there any left? Was the 80s as well a lot the case that people would just be sat around just carving up rails? was that common practice back then?
Well, I missed all that.
Did you?
Yeah, when I got into comedy, it was all bottles of water and 5-year plans. But now it's all But back then. In the 90s.
What, a lot of AA people?
Well, mate, it was just littered with coke. And, I remember there's a comic, I don't know if I should name him. Glenn Wall, fuck it. Glenn Wall is one of my best, he's one of my favourite comics. I love Glenn Wall. And there's a story about him being off his fucking head. on pills, and to the point where halfway through his set, someone had to go on stage and turn him round because he was talking to the curtain. I love shit like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But is that kind of gone?
Yeah.
Like, well, like no, it is in the music industry, because now obviously people would just film it on their phone, stick it on YouTube or Facebook, it goes viral, and then their career's drastically fucking damaged, well, isn't it?
There's that, and then you have to, again, you know, there's fewer comedy places, like fewer places on bills than there are comedians. So you can't afford to be fucked. If you go into a green room now and you're doing Lines of Charlie off the menu, they're not going to book you. They're like, "Oh, you're a liability, and I can't have that." Whereas back in the day, you know, it was like, "Yeah, fuck it."
As part
of it. So it just changes now. It's more work based. You have. It's all about being a professional. And yeah, afterwards you can get hammered. Afterwards you can go and do whatever you want to do. But in the moment of the gig, you have to take it seriously, and that's the difference now. You know, we're not doing Lines of Charlie. And there are party animals out there, but they don't do it at gigs. They go off and they'll do it.
Have you partied with anyone?
Tom Stade is a mate of mine, Canadian comic, one of the best in the business as well. He and I have been pretty fucked. I remember him, he came back to mine. I used to live in Greenwich with my ex-wife. And we got back, we had a few drinks, and he goes, "Oh, have you got anything else?" I'm like, "Oh, I've got this fucking horrible speed that my mate gave me. You know, let's do that." I'm like, "Oh, God." Anyway, so we're doing it. I end up losing my mind and I'm like, I've got to go to bed. I've lost the plot. I don't know what I'm doing. Tom ends up ringing his mum back in Canada on his mobile phone for 3 hours. And I just get coming out. I'm like, "Tom, man, you're gonna wake up all the flats. Chill out." As I'm stood there naked, just off my fucking head. I've partied with many people, but it's always been separate.
Yeah.
To the
show's the show.
Yeah, the show's the show. Then after that, you do whatever you want. And you can get fucked up, like you do a gig Friday, go and get pissed or whatever you got to do on the Friday night afterwards. You got a gig Saturday.
Do you find it hard performing hungover?
Yeah.
It's a struggle, isn't it?
Yeah, that's how last night. I had a couple of drinks.
You've got to be sharp.
Yeah, I can't do it. I can't do it hungover. It would be awful.
Would it really?
Yeah. I'll just be phoning it in. And then I don't have a good gig and then the audience can feel it. And, you know, it's not fair. Especially if you're emceeing.
Yeah.
It's not fair on the other acts. If you're just walking up going, "Oh, fuck, man, I'm fucked." Yeah. Because it's your responsibility to get the night into a certain place where the acts can come on and then ride that wave and do the best that they can be the best comedians they can be. And if you're fucking it up in between, you're just ruining it for everybody. So, yeah, you have to be more professional, which is a shame. I heard some stories. I'd love to. Yeah.
Dude, pleasure.
Thanks, man.
This is the first double podcast I've ever done.
It's been a long day, isn't it?
It's been a great day. Well, I was thinking on the way here, I was like, I'm so grateful for what I get to do for a living.
Oh, absolutely.
If I had to do just a regular job, there's certain days where, you know, I'm a bit tired, a bit jaded, like me, I'm talking about this, a bit hungover. And it's like, hang on, what I'm about to go and do is chat to my mate for a couple of hours.
Exactly.
And it's such a blessing, and I love it.
But we can do this, and we can...
Congratulations with all the fucking success so far.
Oh,
and
thanks,
keep
man.
Going with the podcast.
Yeah, pleasure, man. Thank you very much.
If people want to check it out, it's on all the platforms. It's called Insane in the Men Brain. And it's great. And there's loads of great guests on there, including myself.
Yes, mate.
Michael Smiley, though, as well.
Smiley was a beautiful one.
Have you got any coming up you can tease?
Yeah.
You want to tease a couple coming up?
Who have we got coming out? I can't remember. Scroobius Pip.
Nice.
We did one with him the other week. He's coming on. We're trying to get Prince Harry.
You were telling me this last
night. Yeah, because he's just announced something with Oprah Winfrey about mental health. And because my podcast is a lot about mental health, we were like, right, let's email him. So we my missus put the word out, does anyone have any contact details? Someone came back and went, yep, here you go. So we're going to, it obviously goes through someone, it doesn't go directly to him, but we're trying to get Prince Harry.
Fingers crossed, mate, because once you've got him on, as I learned with John Lydon, and that's way fucking higher than that.
Yeah, man.
Is it opens doors and gets other guests a lot more excited and willing to come on the show.
Exactly.
One of the royal families being on.
Yeah, man.
Do you know what I mean? They're going to come flooding.
Of course they are. We'll get Iggy Pop, pair of us.
Fucking A. good luck tonight.
Thanks, man.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.